court is ready to hear oral argument in Wayne, from petitioner in Wayne T. Nance II versus Resolution Trust Corporation as receiver for Alamo Savings of Texas, etc.
Hey, please report. This is John McGetter, representing Arkansas Corporation.
Good morning, gentlemen. This is a case involving a breach of contract. The contract involved is a construction loan agreement between a builder as the borrower and a lender relating to the construction of a townhome condominium development project. The petitioner was the builder, plaintiff, and appellant in the lower court. He sued the respondent, the lender, under a theory that the lender's failure to fund under the construction loan forced him into default on the obligation underlying the loan, and his damage was the amount that he owed as a result of this default.
Were you ever asking for the profits that might have been made?
No, Judge. That was never a part of our case.
Were you asking for the expenses that you had incurred to date plus the liability that you had incurred?
Exactly.
Was your pleadings, were your pleadings based upon Section 349, the restatement of contracts?
Liberally construed, yes. Did we ask that? No. The pleadings were never objected to. The Court of Appeals opinion points out that in their view, our pleadings were for lost profits. I take exception. If you read the paragraph in our pleadings where we allege breach of contract, we are specifically stating our damage is the very same damage that I'm arguing to the court.
You're referring to paragraph 2 of plaintiff's 6th amended original petition?
No, sir. I'm referring to paragraph 6 where we allege breach of contract. The Court of Appeals referred to paragraph 2. What they failed to do was refer to the specific paragraph in our pleadings where we allege breach of contract and state what we believe our damage is and why. Trial court granted, first of all, three issues were submitted to the jury: breach of contract, what our damage was from the breach of contract, and whether we waived the right to complain of breach of contract. All three issues decided in our favor. Trial court grants a judgment NOV. The Court of Appeals reversed the trial court, finding that there was some evidence to support the breach of contract finding. There was some evidence to support the damages finding as related to out-of-pocket expenses, but held that we failed to prove our damage under a lost profit theory. The sole point of error before the court this morning is whether the Court of Appeals was in error in restricting its consideration to the evidence under a lost profit theory. We believe, under the state of this record, the Court of Appeals was required to reverse the trial court if there was any evidence under any theory to support the jury's finding. The standard of review the Court of Appeals had to apply to this particular case was to consider all of the evidence in the record most favorable to the jury verdict, all the inferences from the evidence in favor of the verdict, reject evidence and inferences contrary to the verdict, and if it found more than a scintilla of evidence to support the jury's finding, the Court of Appeals was under an obligation to reverse the NOV and render on the jury verdict. We pled, argued, and tried our case upon the theory that the respondent's breach of this construction loan agreement caused us to incur a debt we would not have otherwise incurred, and that debt incurred our damages in part. These facts support the jury's verdict. We as the borrower were looking for a financial partner and not a lender, and would not have agreed on the loan format but for the fact that it was a 100% funded loan concept, which meant all monies to build this project were to come from the loan proceeds. The only limitation being we had to be within the budget or within the loan limit. If cost of construction exceeded the loan limit, that came out of our pocket. There was no profit built into the builder's aspect of this loan. The only thing that would be funded would be the cost of construction with the profit to be received at the time the project was completed and sold. There was enough money in the loan balance to fund completion of the contract and construction. The petitioner believed and testified that he could minimally break even if he was given the opportunity to complete the construction loan. The petitioner suffered significant personal financial changes during the course of construction, depleting cash reserves that he had and limiting his financial ability to just support his family, much less incur the kind of debt and pay back the kind of debt involved in this construction loan. The construction came to a stop when the respondent refused to fund draw requests. The petitioner could not complete the project from his own personal funds. The project closed down because the respondent refused to fund and refused to instruct the borrower to go back to work, agreeing to fund. These are all facts in the records, all of which support our theory of damages. From these facts, I believe the following inferences in support of the jury verdict can be drawn. One, the petitioner expected to repay the loan from the sale of the project after completion. Two, the petitioner could not repay the loan without being allowed the opportunity to complete. Denying petitioner the opportunity to complete the construction created a debt which he could not pay, and that petitioner's indebtedness was a natural and foreseeable consequence of the respondent's breach. I need to point this out because it is critical to the legal arguments I'm making to you all this morning. The defendant respondent did not object to the court's charge in any respect. We believe that the failure to object to the submission of the contract question and the damages question left the Court of Appeals to construe the record, not whether or not we sued under a proper theory or under a proper measure, but whether or not we proved damages under any theory. If there had been an objection on the theory, maybe we'd have a problem. There was no objection, and the authorities that I have cited to you support the position I'm taking. Morgan versus Letelier was a Houston case, 14th District, 1964, I believe, where the plaintiff sued to recover real estate commissions. It was a breach of an agreement to pay real estate commissions. The case was submitted to the jury on a negligence question. The Court of Appeals said, clearly the case was submitted on an improper theory, but defendant's failure to object waived the right to complain of the finding. This court, in a 1981 decision, Cameron versus Terrell and Garrett, Inc., which I have cited to you in my brief, makes the same point. In the DTPA action, an improper measure of damages was defined and submitted to the jury upon which it made its finding. Defendant failed to object. Appellate court reversed. Supreme Court held that the failure to object waived the right to complain of the theory or measure submitted. Tom Benson Chevrolet versus Alvarado, San Antonio Court of Appeals, 1984. Same thing, same result. Failure to object to the theory submitted constitute a waiver of the right to make that complaint. I believe that the failure to object to the submission of the question could arguably mean the jury's verdict stands if there was any evidence to support the finding, and there was evidence to support the finding. But if there
not evidence to support that measure, you're saying, but just evidence to support the finding of this amount based on the incorrect instruction.
Yes, exactly. But if we're looking for a legal theory to support the finding, I'm prepared and would like to argue these theories in support of what the jury found as damages. First of all, review of general principles relating to compensation for parties who have suffered a breach of contract. Just compensation for the loss or damage actually sustained is the general measure, the universal rule for measuring damages for breach of contract based on Stewart versus Bassey, a 1952 decision of this court. Placing the party in a position he would have occupied but for the injury is a principle espoused in State National Bank versus Farrah Manufacturing and Mistletoe Express Service, which I have cited to you all in my brief. One party to a contract will not be permitted to take advantage of his wrongful failure to perform on his part, thereby rendering performance by the other party impossible and then escape liability. Dockery versus Dunham and Davis bumper to bumper, both cases I've cited in the brief, but the point is this. Under these general principles, allowing for compensation to the party agreed, it is clear, if you accept our theory and inferences from our evidence, This man was damaged by being forced into a condition that was not his fault, and his damage was the amount of liability he incurred as a result of it.
Has any court in Texas adopted Restatement 349?
Mistletoe.
And if we adopted it, does that solve the problem?
I believe it does. But the Fourth Court has said mistletoe is not applicable, so when I get to that part of my argument, I'll tell you why the Fourth Court was wrong. Unless you want to hear it now, but rolling along. Consequential damages is a theory that exists in the state, which I believe would support the recovery of these type of damages. From the inferences from the evidence, it is clear that the parties expected this loan to be repaid from the completion of construction and the sale of the project. If that could not happen, the net result will be the borrower cannot repay, a direct, natural, foreseeable consequence of the breach. Mead versus Johnson Group, a 1981 decision of this court, and then Investors versus Hadley, an Austin 1987 decision is cited to this court for authority for the proposition that consequential damages are recoverable in a breach of contract action. Recovery might be supported on the basis that to deny recovery would result in an equitable, would produce an inequitable result and allow unjust enrichment. In Mead versus Johnson Group, the Senate, the Supreme Court case that I have cited, the Supreme Court rejected a long line of authorities relating to proof of damages to allow the injured party to recover his damages because it said to do otherwise would produce an inequitable result and provide unjust enrichment to the breaching party. The reasoning in Mead would apply to the reasoning in Nance. If you were to accept the singular argument that lost profits is the only theory and apply a long line of authority, what you would do is you would leave this man under these circumstances without a remedy because he could not prove lost profits. Another theory to be, which would support this judgment, this verdict, would be the reliance damages in Section 349 of the Restatement of Torts. I did not cite to the court Section 344, but Section 344 discusses what are reliance damages. Defines it, tells you what it is. Section 345D says that there is a judicial remedy available for recovery of reliance damages, and that it includes a judgment awarding a sum of money to prevent unjust enrichment. The very argument we're making here. These are basic authorities in the restatement, which I believe support our position. Mistletoe Service versus Locke is the case which applied reliance damages out of the restatement to the facts before that case in a breach of contract case. In that case, the defendant prematurely breached a contract which the plaintiff, in order to perform, went out, borrowed money, bought equipment, and incurred expenses. The jury awarded the plaintiff its damages, which were the amounts of money it borrowed, the amounts of money it paid in interest, and the amounts of money it spent for equipment. All of these were defined by the Mistletoe Court as being recoupment expenses. The defendant argued the only proper theory under this case, breach of contract, was plaintiff's lost profit. And since the evidence showed that the plaintiff operated unprofitably during the life of the contract, no damage. Mistletoe says no. Under this circumstance, expectation damages, which are lost profits damages, aren't the only measure. Look to a secondary source of recovery, reliance damages. Reliance damages provided the plaintiff a recovery, and they disregarded lost profits because lost profits would not have provided such a recovery and went with the reliance damages. Judge Peoples, in his opinion, said Mistletoe doesn't apply because we did not plead reliance damages. I think a liberal construction of the pleadings would show that although we didn't call them reliance damages, our theory is these were reliance damages. But even then, I think the defendant's failure to object to the pleadings in any respect or the submission of the question waived the complaint that the issue or the damages were not pled and they were tried by implied consent. So that overcomes their...
Counsel, you did plead that your damages were the full sums you owed Alamo plus the $85,000 you had spent, didn't
you? Yes.
Isn't that the definition of reliance?
as under a recruitment theory, and I'm not saying clearly, but I think so, yes. That was our pleading. There was a separate paragraph in the pleading that defined what our damages was, and I think that's where that came from.
Judge Peeble stated in
footnote number three, page 11,
of his opinion that accept your argument would enable any non-breaching party to a loan contract wipe out the entire deficiency of Reliance expense without proof that the underlying project would have been successful.
Well, Judge, that's the flaw. That is the flaw, because under Reliance damages, a party, the breaching party, has the right to prove an offset. Judge Peoples didn't address that. What he is doing is he's looking at it from the borrower's point of view, saying the borrower can avoid liability under this theory, and the lender is stuck with discharge of the deficiency balance. The Reliance rule in its entirety specifically provides that the lender in this circumstance could prove the offset, but it puts the burden on the breaching party to prove the offset. Doesn't make that a part of the wronged party's case. I think that is fair. If you were to look at this case, Nance is the fellow who was wrong. The other side breached the party and put him into his position. He proves his damages. But the Reliance rule doesn't stop there. It says the party who breaches can go in and prove an offset to it. I don't think Judge Peoples addressed that. I think his interpretation gives lenders a free hand to determine at any time during a construction loan, when they determine it's not feasible, to just stop funding and sue and recover a deficiency balance. And the borrower under that circumstance is limited to a remedy that may not exist, because in changing market conditions, you may not be able to prove with requisite certainty lost profits.
To be clear, the $993,000 found by the jury that you're seeking to recover is not in addition to the lease from liability on the note, is it?
No, it is an offset to it. That was our theory. There are a number of reasons why this is all so confused, but the bottom line is, what we were going to do is we were liable on the note. We were creating an offset to that liability. We argued $950 to the jury plus $86,000 in out-of-pocket expenses, and they came back with $993, which is actually one half the out-of-pockets plus the $950 in the deficiency balance.
It might have been clear to me for precision or some escape from liability on the note plus the out-of-pocket damage.
It sure would have, Judge. Sure would have. But here we are. There are two authorities that you all can consider in addressing any argument whether lost profit is the only theory available to us. In Manny versus Burgess, a Fort Worth opinion in 1961, that court held that under the state of the record and based on the authority of Stewart versus Bassey, and since lost profits didn't provide an adequate remedy, there was an alternative. The same in the Mistletoe case. Both Manny versus Burgess and Mistletoe Express tell you that if applying lost profits is the only applicable theory, look someplace else, because it doesn't afford the plaintiff a proper remedy. I think we need to keep in mind at all times, Mr. Nance did not do wrong, or did no wrong. He was the party who was wrong. And what we did was we recovered an amount of money that would make him whole and would punish the wrongdoer for its precipitous act.
Any questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear oral argument from respondent.
Mr. Joseph Thompson and Mr. Eric Freeden will present argument for respondent. Mr. Freeden,
may it please the court, I'm here with co-counsel today representing the Resolution Trust Corporation as receiver of Alamo Savings Association of Texas and as conservator for Alamo Federal Savings Association of Texas. Co-counsel and I are splitting up the argument. I will address the point of error that the application for writ was granted on, and Mr. Cassab will address the offset issue that was raised in the supplemental brief. I think the main point to emphasize here is that it is our position that the Court of Appeals in this case wrote a well-reasoned opinion that correctly states the law.
One always thinks it's well-reasoned when you win.
That is correct, Your Honor. And we have no problem with that. It is our position that the Court of Appeals did not limit their review of the argument that the balance of damages that the jury awarded should be given. The Court of Appeals, in effect, went through a checklist of theories of damages.
Counsel, do you recognize the reliance interest theory of damages, which is set forth under Section 344 of the Restatement of Contracts?
We certainly recognize that as a theory of damages recovery. We certainly do. However, the Court of Appeals pointed out in its footnote on page 11, I believe, and talked about the mistletoe case, said that that is, it, first of all, was not pled. Second of all, that if you look at the pleadings of the petitioner and the evidence such that it was put forth, that reliance damages is not what he was talking about. In the plaintiff's sixth amended original petition.
Well, he sure talked about it in the jury charge. There wasn't any doubt about it when he saw the jury charge, and that's what he was asking.
That he was asking for reliance damages?
Wasn't that the effect of the jury question?
Well, the jury question was, you know, number one, was there a breach? And number two, if there was, then what were the damages? It's our position that based upon the pleadings, he said that in his pleadings that the damages set forth in paragraph 2, I'm quoting from the sixth amended original petition, the damages set forth in paragraph 2 above form the plaintiff's basis for its damage claim under this theory of recovery, breach of contract. Paragraph 2, in essence, says, if Alamo had not changed the manner of their dealings with the petitioner, that they could have completed the project, could have sold all the units within the time sufficient to repay the debt, the note, without any loss to the petitioner or to Alamo.
Doesn't he also say in his pleading that his damages are the full sums owed to Alamo plus the $85,000 that he has spent?
That is correct, Your Honor.
Well,
and
does that not, by its very definition, constitute reliance damages because he's not asking for lost profits?
Well, we construe what he's asking for as a, not necessarily lost profits, but lost revenue. And the theory is the same. If I could have finished this project and sold all the units, then I could have repaid the loan. And if you go take it the next step, there was virtually no evidence that he could have completed the project or resold any of those units in time.
If you're just asking for reliance damages, though, or reliance interest, you don't have to prove that. When you ask for merely to cancel the debt and to give you back your out-of-pocket expenses, you shift the burden to the other side, do you not?
Yes, it is correct, sir. But that is not what he was asking for, in our opinion. In our opinion, he pled that he was entitled to the balance of the damages that was awarded to the jury because he could have finished the project and made enough money, whether they be profits or merely revenues, in order to pay back the loan.
What if he hadn't made money? What if he couldn't have finished it in, or else he would have lost money? Isn't he still entitled not to have to pay the obligation to the breaching party? Maybe he is or is not entitled to get back lost profits beyond, above and beyond that, or to recover some additional loss that he lost besides that. But how does that relate to his not being able to recover just the amount that he owes the breaching party under this agreement?
Well, it's our position that he would be entitled to receive the damages which he could prove. Now, the whole trial focused on the retainage clause in the contract and the line item requests, the draws on the line item requests. Evidence was put forth that resulted in approximately $86,000 worth of out-of-pocket expenses. And the Court of Appeals, when they looked at the judgment NOV, said, well, it seems like there was some evidence of breach of contract. And they reversed, according to the correct standard, reversed the trial court's granting of the judgment NOV. So they reversed this to the issue of liability, and then they said, okay, let's look at the damages, okay? There's damages, clear in the evidence, looks like there's about $86,000 damages. Now let's look at the balance, okay? Where's the proof? Whether it be reliance or lost revenue, lost profits, expectation damages, loss of bargain, and by the way, the Court of Appeals talked about every single one of those in their opinion. And they said, based upon the pleadings that he has pled about, I think I could have finished the project and sold him, what he's talking about is lost revenue or lost profit. And how does he get from the $86,000 of the out-of-pocket expenses to the rest?
The lost profits is the amount he would have made more than he owed.
Well, let's just call it lost revenue, just enough to break even. How does he get from the $86,000 to the balance of those damages? There has to be some proof to support that.
Wasn't there introduction of the note as to how much he owed on the note?
Yes, Your Honor, there was.
Now, the Court of Appeals attempted to distinguish mistletoe by saying in mistletoe that the party had already spent the money, so it was clear what his damages were. In this case, they said, well, he spent $85,000, but the rest of it, he really hasn't had to pay yet. He merely signed a note to Alamo for, so therefore, it's not really an expenditure. But if you sign a note, don't you have to pay it?
Yes, you do, Your Honor.
What's the difference between spending $85,000, say, for lumber and signing a note to someone else?
Well, to be quite honest, I'm not sure I understand your question, Your Honor.
I don't understand the Court of Appeals distinction that they made in footnote 3 on page 12.
Well, they talk about the mistletoe case and said the court permitted him to recover the amount that he still owed the lender, and then he went on to say that is a different matter from allowing recovery by Nance for the deficiency on the loan itself when Alamo's breach was a failure to fully fund the loan.
Do you agree that he was not asking in this case for lost profits?
No, Your Honor. I respectfully disagree. I think that from the tenor of his pleadings, he was asking what was tantamount to lost profits, because the balance of those damages was equal to what he would have received if he would have finished the project, sold all the units, and by the way, there was no testimony anywhere that was a possibility, but that's to say, he said, I could finish the project, I can sell all these units, and I will receive enough money to pay back what I owe. Now that...
You left out the words, without a loss.
Without a loss.
So he wouldn't have made a profit.
Well, whether it's lost revenue, even if it's a break even, that amount still has to be proven up, and it wasn't.
It's the amount, whatever he's at.
Well,
whatever he owes the limit.
Well.
That's the amount, and what proof is necessary?
Well, it's our position that damages, no matter what they are, under any theory, have to be proven. And if that balance of damages, whether it be characterized as lost profits or lost revenues, have to be proved with a reasonable amount of certainty. Now, we know that petitioner would like us to believe that if you look at any other theory, then all I have to do is put forth a scintilla of evidence. And that's why he wants to get away from this idea of lost profits, lost revenue, lost whatever. The Court of Appeals focused on that because that was the only reasonable theory of recovery of damages after they went through this checklist of reliance, expectation, loss of bargain. That was a 22-page opinion. They spent 7 pages on the damages, and they looked at it very closely. They said,
if it could be established in this case that he could only have sold this project when completed at $200,000 loss, wouldn't he still be out the money that he owed the lender as a result of the breach? Given the $200,000 just an additional amount that he might or might not be able to recover, he would still be out the deficiency.
That is correct, Your Honor.
Counsel, your light flashed. I don't know whether you're going to save time.
Yes, I'm finished with my time. Mr. Castle will continue.
Thank you, Counsel.
May it please the Court. Your Honor, I'm here to address an issue that was raised in a supplemental brief, and that was the issue of whether or not the Court of Appeals attempt to offset the judgment awarded in favor of Petitioner Nance against the deficiency balance judgment awarded in favor of then Alamo. And in order to properly address that point, I'd like to direct the Court's attention to the notice of substitution that was filed and of record on March 14th, approximately a month before the Court of Appeals rendered its decision. In that notice of substitution, it was clearly pointed out that Alamo Savings Association had been placed into a receivership. The receivership had, in fact, been in place on June 28th, 1989. On that very same date, a conservatorship was established, if you will, where a new chartered federal mutual savings and loan named Alamo Federal Savings Association of Texas was established. Now, the old Alamo remained in the receivership, and the RTC became the receiver for that receivership. And Alamo Federal, which I call New Alamo, became the conservatorship with the RTC acting as a conservator. And this is what this was accomplished through what's known as a pass-through transaction, where the assets passed from old Alamo into New Alamo, and the liabilities remained with old Alamo. Now, this was all pointed out not only in detail in the notice of substitution, but again in footnote number one of our response to the petitioner's brief. The point to be made here is that the Court of Appeals had this before it when it rendered its opinion in April of 1990. And reading from the last page of that opinion, after the Court had already addressed, both in the style of the case and in the body of the case, in the separation of these two entities, said, and I quote, judgment is rendered for appellant in the amount of $86,000 on the jury's verdict, which is ordered offset against Alamo's recovery for the deficiency. For some reason, the Court of Appeals did not take into consideration what they had already determined early in the opinion, and that is the complete identity of interests between these two parties. Because there's a lack of clarity in that language, the Resolution Trust Corporation, acting both as a conservator for New Alamo and a receiver for Old Alamo, having no mutual obligations between the two, feels that that issue of offset needs to be cleared up. And to underscore that point, we would say that the $954,000 plus judgment remains in place as of today. It's not been appealed, it's not been the subject of an appeal. That judgment belongs to the conservator, has been set out in this notice of substitution. The $86,000 in damages belongs to the receiver. One shall not offset the other under the federal law and federal statutes. And what we need is a clarification from this court so that any mandate it renders back to the trial court is clear whether we're going to have two judgments, which is what the Court of Appeals appears to say, or one judgment reduced by an amount of $86,000. And with that clarification, then the conservator can take that judgment and attempt to enforce that judgment.
at the time the judgment was rendered by the trial court, should there have been an offset or not?
It is my opinion that, I agree with you, Justice Heck, in my opinion, the proper pleading should have been a rescission on the note. And that at the time the court ordered an offset, if the court found at that time an offset was appropriate, the court could have ordered an offset. But what I'm saying in today's light, now that there are two separate distinct parties who have no mutuality of obligations, we have a problem interpreting what the court is doing. Is the court saying there's going to be two judgments or one? And the reason that's important is because federal statute, U.S. Code 12, Section 1821, gives the receiver the sole discretion to distribute assets and pay claims. And the question is, until we get a judgment fashioned that makes sense, we don't know whether or not error is going to rise because of this offset language, and whether or not it will be have to attack it at that time because of a restraint or an interference with the receiver's congressionally mandated discretion to distribute assets, of which this judgment would constitute one. We would simply ask this court to look at the language of the Court of Appeals and take into consideration the substitution that's been on file and never objected to, and also ask this court that if for any reason the court would like, in a post-submission brief, we'll be happy to attach certified copies of the inch or so thick pass-through documents that detail everything that has been set forth in the notice of substitution. But as a practical matter, until we know whether we have one or two judgments, we don't know how to go about enforcing it pursuant to the rights the conservator has when it took this judgment. In conclusion, the Resolution Trust Corporation would simply point out to this court that the Court of Appeals did apply the proper standard of review and did not limit its review to lost profits simply by the unofficial checklist you'll find in that opinion, where they looked at four or five various theories. The reason they keep coming back to lost profits is because that's exactly the way the petitioner in his Sixth Amendment petition filed 2 weeks before trial got us from A to B. And that's the theory he gave us. And I think the Court of Appeals was looking for the most rational theory, although they looked at several others. Secondly, it is critical at this point, before this court fashions any type of judgment or sends a mandate back, that this court take into consideration the complete distinction between the Resolution Trust Corporation acting as a receiver and holding the liabilities, now found to be $86,000, and the Resolution Trust Corporation acting as a conservator for an entirely new savings and loan, New Alamo, Alamo Federal, in holding its judgment of $954,000.
Any questions? Thank you, counsel.
All right, first of all, I take strong exception to the fact that the Court of Appeals considered anything but lost profits. If you look at the opinion, all the Court of Appeals did was discuss the Meade case and Investors case that we cited in our appellate brief and say that since these cases did not discuss lost profits, they did not apply. All other theories and arguments were not addressed. And in the motion for rehearing, where we point this out and ask the Court to reconsider our arguments in the light that they were made, the Court of Appeals simply says, in its opinion on the motion for rehearing, refer back to our original opinion. So there was not this discussion that's been represented to you. It did not take place. The only thing the Court of Appeals did was conclude that what we were asking for was lost profits, and we didn't prove lost profits. I want to address the second point that I was made aware of on Monday morning. And I filed a responsive pleading that I don't even know what it means, but it's some response to what they are attempting to do, and it goes along these lines. If they had a complaint with the opinion of the Court of Appeals and the way it rendered its judgment, they needed to preserve that complaint by bringing it to the Court of Appeals' attention, which they did not do, and had not done anything until Monday of this week, pointing out the fact that there is this conservator-receiver dichotomy. Secondly, they are asking you to grant affirmative relief in their favor. They are seeking to avoid the consequences of any judgment that you may render, if it is rendered in favor of petitioner, by saying they internally divided this single judgment
giving part of it to a receiver who has no assets upon which it becomes meaningless, and the liability aspect they give to a conservator who can go out and be free to collect. All of this is done on the basis of one pleading, which is a motion to substitute, which constitutes unsubstantiated hearsay conclusions and could not be the basis for any affirmative relief that these men are seeking at this point in time. The only thing before this court is the judgment that was rendered in the trial court, appealed to the Court of Appeals, and now before you, all one singular issue. And yes, we are strongly advocating that if you all agree with us and reverse and render on the jury verdict, that constitutes an offset against any liability we may owe this one entity. And I would take exception to the fact that they have the authority to do what they did. This is not a purchase and assumption transaction. They did not take the assets of a failed institution and pass them on to a successor institution. They divided them amongst themselves.
Any questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument in all these causes. Just Ray, do you have a final question?
No.
Ask anybody? And that concludes the business of the court for the day. The foregoing cases are submitted on briefs and oral arguments, and the marshal will now please adjourn the court.
Please rise.